This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Pressure's mounting on the Albanese government to address the deportation of New Zealanders from Australia. Thousands of Kiwis have been deported for committing criminal offences, even though some of them had been in Australia for nearly their entire lives. New Zealand's leader, Jacinda Ardern, will raise the controversial program during formal talks with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese today. Matt Bamford reports.
Ben Stackpole was 16 years old when he arrived in Australia. 29 years later, his life was upended when he was deported to New Zealand after serving time for assault and burglary.
He didn't really tell me till the last minute, till I was ready to get out, and I thought I was getting parole and I was all happy, and then they told me probably the day before that I was going to the detention centre instead of going home. Yeah, and after that, I went to the detention centre about 3 months. That was rough. I'd rather have been in jail than that place.
Under Section 501 of the Migration Act, anyone who's served more than 12 months in jail can have their visa revoked. Thousands of Kiwis like Ben Stackpole have been forced to make a new life in a foreign country.
I've got a 21-year-old son in Brisbane, which is hard. You know, it's pretty hard to talk on the phone. And every time we talk on the phone, he hangs up and ends up dying.
After the Coalition tightened migration rules in 2014, visa cancellations jumped 15-fold and New Zealanders became one of the largest nationalities in immigration detention. For years, the New Zealand government has lobbied for reform, without luck. This week, opposition leader and former immigration minister Peter Dutton defended the action, describing deportees as serious criminals.
People had committed sexual offences against women and children, the drug dealers, the traffickers, people had committed murder.
But Monash University's Rebecca Powell says that's not always true.
No, it's not always the case, and I think increasingly we are seeing evidence of non-citizens being deported for crimes that are not so serious, such as drink driving and drug offending.
Philippa Payne is from New Zealand-based advocacy group Route 501.
Some of the people that have been placed through this process committed a crime 20 or 30 years ago. Many of them have been rehabilitated. Many of them have been law-abiding citizens.
She says their punishment continues even after they're deported.
And then they get here at the airport and they have their DNA taken, they have their fingerprints taken, and they have their mugshot taken. And most of them are put on a probationary service for a crime that's not even committed in New Zealand.
On her first visit to Australia since the election, New Zealand's leader Jacinda Ardern is expected to raise the matter with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Ben Stackpole remains hopeful for change.
Give us another chance. That's all I want. I want to see my son. You know, I've got my family, my dad, he's in his 70s, my mum, everyone's over there.
Deportee Ben Stackpole, ending that report from Matt Bamford. Dealing with spiralling energy costs is the first major hurdle confronting Anthony Albanese's new government. And now senior federal government sources have told AM that the Snowy 2.0 pumped hydro project will be delayed by at least 19 months, meaning it won't be able to dispatch power until the latter part of this decade. It's yet another complication as energy ministers grapple with stabilising the national energy grid. Earlier this week, they agreed to create a so-called capacity market to pay generators to have extra power available when the system needs it. But renewable energy advocates say that'll just extend the life of coal-fired power stations. Yet the man who oversaw WA's so-called capacity markets rejecting those claims, saying the policy's working in his state and isn't stopping the exit of coal. With more, here's energy reporter Daniel Mercer.
For more than 5 years last decade, Ray Challon was Western Australia's energy supremo. Throughout that time, he was ultimately in charge of the state's capacity market, in which power generators are paid to make sure they're available when the system needs them. He says it was as uncontroversial as it was effective.
We have a capacity market because we're not prepared to rely solely on those free market forces. It's more conservative, but it's also looking at what the customers want.
The idea of a capacity market has been thrust into the spotlight this week after a meeting between federal and state energy ministers recommended one for the eastern states. Driving the discussion was the crisis in the national electricity market on Australia's east coast, where coal and gas shortages have sent prices soaring. Ray Challon says the design of the NEM is amplifying the problems because it's an energy-only market. which means generators only get paid for the power they produce. He says that's allowing renewable energy to push out coal, but not doing enough to bring on new supplies of reliable generation required to replace it.
The characteristic of wind and solar energy is that once you've actually got your generation plant built, the energy is effectively costless, and they're all bidding in at the same zero, close to zero price. And so we're actually going to have to find other mechanisms for paying these generation businesses to be there and to be operating. And the obvious mechanism that is there is for a capacity market element.
Johanna Boyer is an analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. She says a capacity market is a bad idea because it would prolong the life of coal-fired power and saddle consumers with higher costs. She argues a better idea would be a target for renewable electricity storage.
The proposal in its current form does include paying coal and gas power plants. So there's concern that that proposal might actually delay decarbonisation by keeping the coal and gas power plants in the system for longer.
But not everyone agrees. Kerry Schott is the former chair of the Energy Security Board. She says most other major markets in the world are moving towards capacity mechanisms to deal with the switch to renewable energy.
Once you've got quite a lot of renewables in the system, you do need something to make sure that you've got firm capacity there. It's to replace a situation where there's a wind drought or it's not sunny, like in the, you know, in the winter when you get a still day, that sort of thing. Just basically makes a payment, gives some reward to firm plants to be available. The capacity market is really just an insurance exercise.
It's a view shared by Ray Challen.
The experience in capacity markets to date has certainly been that capacity markets are certainly not keeping coal-fired power in business. Coal-fired power generators will not exist in the market purely as a capacity play or to receive capacity payments, because the nature of coal is it actually has to be running to be viable.
That's Ray Challen, WA's former coordinator of energy, Daniel Mercer, with that report. Still on the hot-button issue of power, while energy ministers this week committed to accelerating investment in renewable energy, one consumer advocate says they also need to make it easier for consumers to find an electricity deal that includes a component of renewable energy. National Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge explains.
Like many Australians, Rosemary Marcon is doing her best to deal with the rising cost of energy.
During the pandemic, that's when it really hit us in terms of how inefficient the house was, because suddenly our gas bills were going up and we weren't really staying very warm.
She'd planned to change her heating to electric and install rooftop solar panels, only to find out her roof is too small.
Well, it just kind of blew all the plans apart, you know.
Instead, Ms. Marcon has opted for a so-called green power deal, so she can at least still support renewable energy. It means her retailer purchases electricity from renewable generation sources. But she says it wasn't easy to find out if she was signing up to a competitive deal.
And the information's kind of scattered all over the place. So, yeah, it seems like it's way behind in terms of where the population's at in terms of what it wants and needs.
Gavin Dufty from St Vincent de Paul Society is worried that people without rooftop solar will unfairly shoulder the burden of rising electricity prices. He thinks a higher uptake of green deals could force energy companies to transition away from fossil fuels even sooner and prevent people who can't afford rooftop solar from being left behind. His analysis of prices shows big differences between deals.
There's huge dispersion in price, so some are quite competitive to 100% green is quite competitive to non-green products. Some of the 100% green are incredibly expensive. There's a big range in price in there. They're really confusing to actually work out, you know, what you're getting and how much you're paying.
He wants regulators to look at whether government comparison sites are doing enough to help consumers find and compare green power deals.
Yeah. Step one, some transparency. Step two, some comparability. So transparency, what's there? And then we need the machines to do the numbers for people so they go, yeah, okay, that looks good for me. Then some guidelines around, well, what is a good pricing framework?
Sarah McNamara from the Australian Energy Council says comparison sites are improving.
Green offerings are identified on the government-run comparator site, so customers should be well aware of what's out there in terms of green energy.
The Australian Energy Regulator says it's looking at how it can include green power offers on its comparison site, and it encourages customers to look at retailers' competitive market offers.
National Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge. Energy prices aren't the only problem facing households. Food's becoming increasingly expensive as inflation takes hold. While many of us are balking at the extraordinary prices of iceberg lettuce, entire fields of them are rotting in the ground in Queensland's Lockyer Valley. John Daly reports.
Millions of heads of iceberg lettuce are rotting on Brock Sutton's farm in the Lockyer Valley in southeast Queensland. Each one is covered in brown slime and none are fit for human consumption.
And is that bacteria?
It's bacteria and fungal.
Flood damage to this region is a big reason why shoppers are paying as much as $12 for a head of lettuce, and fast food chains are having to supplement the ingredient. Brock Sutton can barely harvest any of his lettuce crop.
It's devastating. Even despite the prices being where they are, there's not a grower in probably eastern Australia that wants to see things as they are in our industry or in the retail shelves the way that it is.
How much money do you think the flooding and this situation's cost you?
Cost us, business-wide, probably looking at about $7 million in lost income.
The Lockyer Valley is a food bowl and supplies much of the East Coast's lettuce and other vegetables during winter. And many of those crops are unsalvageable after sitting in sodden dirt for months.
The going saying around the valley at the moment that people as old as 80 years old are saying is that this event or series of events is something that's never been seen before.
It'll take months before food production here is back to normal. And the path to recovery for many of these farmers will be long. And Brock Sutton says some growers just won't make it.
I'd be extremely surprised if there aren't growers in the valley in particular that look at what's happened over the past few months and don't hang up the boots.
While the flooding is a major factor here, so is the rising cost of fuel and fertiliser resulting from the war in Ukraine. Edith Cowan University supply chain expert Flavio Macau warns consumers will be facing rising grocery bills for some time.
Price rises will continue for at least another 12 months. You have many contracts that big supermarkets like Coles and Woolies, they have contracts that are 12 months long. So as they renovate those contracts in the coming months, they will see suppliers asking for higher prices.
In the Lockyer Valley, a prolonged drought followed by a series of damaging floods has really hit the morale of Brock Sutton and other farmers.
Yeah, there's plenty of people around, including ourselves, that have had some pretty long periods of quiet reflection and wondering whether it's all worth it.
Lockyer Valley farmer Brock Sutton ending John Daly's report. The former Prime Minister Julia Gillard is calling on state and federal governments to prioritise support and care for people after a suicide attempt. Half of those who leave hospital after an attempt don't receive any aftercare. And leading mental health organisations say such programs are critical in preventing deaths from suicide and need to be made more widely available. With more, here's our national medical reporter, Sophie Scott.
Each day, Alan Earls makes time to meditate. It's part of a routine he says has helped his recovery. A family breakdown 7 years ago saw him spiral into gambling and alcohol addiction. After a suicide attempt, he struggled to get the support he needed.
I had to kind of invent my own kind of recovery around that because it's very hard to talk to people about it.
Only half the people who attempt suicide have access to aftercare after they leave hospital. And then there are those who don't go to hospital at all and are not connected to any support services. Aftercare is tailored to individual needs and it can include a safety plan, clinical support and peer support. Former Prime Minister Julia Gillard, now Chair of Beyond Blue, is calling on governments of every level to make aftercare programs a priority.
All of the statistics tell us the real at-risk period for trying to take your life again is within 3 months, and so that's a critical support window.
Beyond Blue's aftercare program, called The Way Back, has helped more than 15,000 people in the last 4 years. People receive one-on-one assistance from a support worker over 12 weeks. An evaluation of the program obtained by the ABC shows the program has seen suicidal thoughts amongst participants reduced by more than 60% and psychological distress by more than 30%.
So that vital connection with a human being who cares, and that does really matter to someone's willingness to think that maybe I can put my life back together, maybe there's some hope for me in the future.
3,000 Australians die each year from suicide. 65,000 make an attempt. Julia Gillard wants programs to be made more widely accessible.
I mean, it is really unfair that your access to this kind of help can be dependent on where you live in Australia.
The call is supported by other leading mental health organisations across the country. Lifeline has been piloting an aftercare program called Eclipse that has also proven successful. Dr. Anna Brooks is the manager of Lifeline's Research Foundation.
It is absolutely the case that statistics are not destiny. We know that if we can intervene appropriately, we can change the trajectory of people the lives of the people who've made an attempt.
Alan Earls knows firsthand what difference the right support can make. He's now trying to do the same for others.
So I was very fortunate somebody took a leap of faith to give me that opportunity for a second chance.
That's Alan Earls, ending that report by Sophie Scott. A spokesperson for the Health and Aged Care Minister, Mark Butler, says demand for mental health support had surged to record levels across the country. And work's been done to make sure the right resources are in place so that people can get the care they need. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Two Britons who were captured while fighting for Ukraine have been sentenced to death in a court run by pro-Russian rebels. The British government's describing the outcome as a sham, saying the men are being used as political pawns. Europe correspondent Nick Doll reports.
In a courtroom in the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine, three men are about to learn their fate. Wearing camouflage pants and casual tops, they're guided into a caged area. 28-year-old Aidan Aslan, 48-year-old Sean Pinner and Moroccan national Sadoun Brahim sit patiently as the sentences are read out. All three are to be executed after being captured fighting for Ukraine around Mariupol. It's a devastating result, but through the bars, Aidan Aslan remains calm as he talks to the press.
I was hoping the sentence would be a lot fairer, judging the circumstances in which I helped the investigation, and also because I surrendered to the Donetsk People's Republic. I wish it could be different, but God will be the one that would judge me when the time comes.
Aidan Aslan is originally from Nottinghamshire, but he moved to Ukraine in 2018. He became a Marine for the military there and got engaged. Sean Pinner is from Bedfordshire and used to serve in the British Army before joining the Ukrainian Armed Forces. He's got a Ukrainian wife and has lived there for 4 years. Mr. Aslan's local MP is Conservative Robert Jenrick.
This has been a Soviet-era show trial where no evidence has been brought forward to condemn these individuals. These are two British citizens who have been serving in the Ukrainian armed forces long before the illegal invasion of Ukraine by Putin's regime.
The court treated the men not as soldiers but as mercenaries, even though they were part of Ukraine's military. Yuri Sak is an advisor to Ukraine's defence ministry.
According to the Geneva Conventions, they should be recognised as prisoners of war, and if this does not happen, this will constitute, unfortunately, yet another violation of the international laws of war.
The British government has called this sentence a sham, and it says the men are being used as political pawns. Britain is a major donor of weapons to Ukraine, so there is a risk that Russia could use the issue to try to pressure Boris Johnson's government. Robert Jenrick again.
They are perfectly normal prisoners of war. They should be looked after appropriately and released back to Ukraine as soon as possible, potentially as part of a prisoner swap.
Russian media is reporting the three men could face a firing squad if the sentences are carried out. They have 1 month to appeal. This is Nick Doll in London reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Can you imagine if an Australian Prime Minister broke strict COVID-19 lockdown rules, held more than a dozen parties at his official residence, was fined by police for breaking the law, and still managed to keep the job? Today, the chief political commentator at The Independent, John Rentall, on how in the UK Boris Johnson's managed to pull that off. For now, look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.